Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Gray Matter. Well, I think I'm in the minority of people who have not seen what I'm told is the highest grossing movie of all time. This is the sequel to Top Gun called Maverick. I'm not a particularly big Tom Cruise fan. I'm definitely in the minority there. But the reason why I mention it is because Tom Cruise has been one of the celebrities who has popularized the Church of Scientology. He's made it a big part of his public message. And most of the people, what we know about the Church of Scientology, we've learned from, you know, celebrities such as John Travolta and Tom Cruise and people like Leah Remini who have come out of the Church of Scientology and revealed things about the church that are shocking. Well, today we have a man on the program who has written a book, just a riveting book. I cannot recommend this book enough. It was so educational. I went into reading it knowing almost nothing about the Church of Scientology and came away just engrossed in a book that, although is a true story, copiously documented, very carefully, like a journal, but actually reads like an incredible novel. And the name of the gentleman is Mike Rinder. He's on our show today. We're very pleased to have him. And of course, he knows all these people. He got to spend time not only with the movie stars who are involved in the Church of Scientology, but he started out as a young man, actually adjacent to, L. Ron Hubbard, the man who wrote the book, Dianetics. I had actually read Dianetics many years ago, didn't understand it. I have a better clue of it now through the lens of Mike's book. And so we're going to introduce him more properly in a moment and listen to him more than me. But before we do that, as we always do to frame our discussion, we're going to go to our aphorisms board. And of course, these are selected in his honor today. The first one is, the only way you can control people is to lie to them. Because the second you start telling anybody close to the truth, you start releasing him and he gets tougher and tougher to control. That's L. Ron Hubbard. The second one is, it is necessary to happiness of man or woman that he be mentally faithful to himself. Infidelity does not consist in believing or in disbelieving. It consists of professing to believe what he does not believe. That's Thomas Paine. The next one is from a man named William S. Burroughs, who wrote that Scientology is a model control system, a state, in fact, with its own courts, police, rewards, and penalties. We're going to find out more about that from our guest. Next one is again from L. Ron Hubbard, who famously quipped, "You don't get rich writing science fiction. If you want to get rich, you start a religion." And the last one is from our guest. It was quoted, "Because Scientology is perceived and conceived by Scientologists as being this salvation for mankind, you can have people that lie with a very straight face if they believe that what they are doing is protecting the Church of Scientology." So who do we have on the show today? Well, Mike Rinder. He has written an incredible book telling the story of how he escaped from the Church of Scientology at the age of 52 after spending, I believe, 33 years there. But he was also raised in the Church of Scientology. And from his website, he indicates that by the age of 15, he had traveled from Australia with the rest of his family to Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard's home in England twice, first time in 1966 and then again in 1969. Both occasions were for them to participate in advanced Scientology courses and auditing, which he will explain about. They were his parents are very dedicated and committed Scientologists, and that's how he was raised. But shortly after, and this is described in the book, and this almost reads like a Horatio Hornblower type story, young man going off to sea. Shortly after he graduated high school in 1973, he joined the Sea Organization, the Sea Org. This is the dedicated core of Scientology. Sea Org members signed a billion-year commitment, hence the name of his book, A Billion Years, to forward the aims of Scientology and live communally with other Sea Org members, pretty much out of touch with the outside world. And in October 1973, he was aboard Hubbard's ship Apollo, hence the name Sea Organization, and met him for the first time. And Hubbard, to scientists, is the closest thing to God. His word is taken as literal truth, not to be interpreted, only to be understood and followed exactly. And from there, our guest lived really a lifetime in this Sea Org, in this organization. And it's very difficult to put really a name on the Church of Scientology. I don't think it's proper to call it a cult. I don't think it's enough to call it a religion or a way of life. It's really all of these things, isn't it, Mike? Could you describe kind of, you know, I know you've done this before, but give people who aren't familiar with the Church of Scientology kind of a basic understanding, foundational understanding of what the Church of Scientology is all about?
Sure. Hi, it's nice to be here with you today, Leighton. Let me start out with, I will oversimplify this, and in fact, if you ask a Scientologist to describe what Scientology is, they hem and haw and don't have a very good description because it defies a lot of description in many ways. You have to go into some detail in order to understand it. But Scientology is based on the supposed research or discoveries of L. Ron Hubbard. L. Ron Hubbard was a science fiction writer, and in the late 1940s, he decided that he was going to turn his hand to writing nonfiction, and as you mentioned, he wrote this book, Dianetics. The fundamental principle of Dianetics is that you have this unknown part of your mind that he called the reactive mind, which is a stimulus response mechanism, and it causes you unwanted pain, emotions, upsets, and that through the principles that he discovered in Dianetics, you can relieve yourself of all of those and become basically a perfect human who is no longer going to get sick, not even a cold, and will have a perfect memory. Of course, none of that actually came to pass and is not something that can actually be accomplished with Dianetics. And Hubbard then went on and said, look, Dianetics only addressed the mind. There is a larger issue here, which is the spirit. And the spirit is actually senior to the mind, that you as a spiritual being have a mind and a body, but your spiritual beingness is senior to your mind and your body. And that was the start of Scientology. Scientology, Hubbard then said, we need to study and resolve the issues of the spirit in order to really be able to resolve the mind. So Scientology fundamentally believes that you are a spiritual being called a Thetan, and that you over eons have lost your innate powers, that a spiritual being called a Thetan in the beginning was akin to God and had all-knowing, all-seeing omnipotence, and that over time has lost that, and Scientology can restore those abilities to anybody as long as you follow the exact path that is dictated by L. Ron Hubbard in what he called the Bridge to Total Freedom, which is a series of steps that one must follow and participate in Scientology, and each one builds sort of on the one previously until you reach the top levels of Scientology, which are called the operating Thetan levels, where you supposedly attain a state where you are knowing, it's described by Hubbard as knowing cause over matter, energy, space, and time. And this means that you're essentially a sort of a godlike being who is able to operate exterior from your body. You are able to think of things and bring them into reality. And it is a very, very, very advanced state that is promised by Hubbard in Scientology. And Scientologists believe that they are going to achieve this in this lifetime, as long as they participate properly and continue to make progress up the bridge to total freedom. So there is this huge carrot that is dangled out. Unlike many other religious organizations, and I really hesitate, like you say you don't think Scientology should be called a cult, but it shouldn't be called a religion. My usual way of describing it is it's a business masquerading as a religion. I also happen to believe it's a cult, but that's neither here nor there. That's just a label. But certainly, this grand promise is held out. And the difference with Scientology is two things. One, Hubbard claimed that everything in Scientology is based on scientific research. It is where science and religion come together. That's how he described it. And that he claimed that he had researched all these things and discovered all these things that nobody else in the history of the universe has been able to untangle. And that if you do what he says exactly, you will attain this incredible state. You don't have to die and go to heaven to see if the promise of like, Christians have to die. They have to die to find out whether they're going to make it to heaven, and the promise that was offered to them by their faith in their religion is actually fulfilled. Hubbard claims that you can discover whether and achieve these things in this lifetime. So it is a massively enticing carrot. And on top of that, he also claimed that this is the only way to save every man, woman, and child on Earth. That Scientology is the only path to preventing this world from being consumed in a nuclear holocaust and everybody living the rest of eternity in blackness and agony. So there you go. I know it's a little longer than you probably wanted, but
that's
Scientology in a nutshell.
Right. And that last concept, that's called clearing the planet, right?
Correct. Right. That's right.
Yeah. So you've written this brilliant book, and but a couple of things about the book, Mike, I want to sort of ask you about that I found really, well, many things I found really shocking. But one was the incredible level of belief. And this comes up in a number of examples, but maybe the best one, and this ties into what you were just talking about, is in the book you describe in 1986 when you were called together in this public gathering and it was announced that Mr. Hubbard had moved on to this higher state. And you readily accepted this, that he had moved on, that he no longer needed his body, that he had transcended his body and moved on to this higher state. And the Church of Scientology believed this so fervently that actually they expected he was going to come back in either 14 or 21 years. And a huge mansion was built for him post-mortem after he died with the expectation he was going to come back. And to me, that was just mind-blowing, the level of belief. And what's really interesting about your book, many things, but one of the things is you document so well how you progress from a 19-year-old and you just sort of gradually start to question these things. And it leads up until there's a crystallizing moment. Finally, you know, when you're 52 years old and you say, no, this is, you know, you have this epiphany, if we can call it that. And you say, no, this is over. I can't do this anymore. I've got to get out. So my question for you is, Mike, that fervency of belief in Scientology, what do you think is the source of that, where people just so unquestionably follow things that rationally seem ludicrous?
Well, I think that the source of it is L. Ron Hubbard, and he even called himself Source. That's how Scientologists refer to L. Ron Hubbard, as Source. Hubbard convinced Scientologist that he had somehow managed to uncover the secrets of the universe, and that only he had uncovered those things, and that he was sharing them with these lucky people who happened to come across his writings or his lectures, and that the poor, unwashed, uninformed, ignorant wogs, which is what Scientologists refer to non-Scientologists as, are blundering around in a sort of a blind state trying to find the light switch, and he has already turned on the lights and they're all available to anybody. All they have to do is come in and pay their money. And Scientologists believe that they are the only people on Earth who have these answers and are the only people that can save everybody else. Not just save themselves, but save everybody else. And this is a very, very powerful motivating factor. Look, a lot of people believe that anybody that gets into Scientology or any cult or high control group is someone who is vulnerable or weak or, you know, feeble of mind or something. And my experience is the exact opposite. There are a lot of very, very smart, very intelligent, well-meaning people who are involved in Scientology. The vast majority of them are. And what actually, the characteristic that most applies to describe how a Scientologist is someone who has gotten involved in Scientology, apart from those who've been raised in it, because that's all different, that's a whole different sort of dynamic, being raised in something by your parents. But those who come into Scientology later in life, when they, you know, beyond high school level, are empaths. They are people who are looking to not only help themselves, but help others. And this is something that is a big promise in Scientology. And the way that it is described is, we will give you the tools of life. We will give you the tools that you can use to help your children with their education, to help your relationships, to help people at work, to help anybody that you come across who's having emotional problems, who's constantly sick. We have the tools that we will give to you for a price that you can then use to help those other people. And that sort of empathetic individual responds extremely well to the promise of being able to help others, and also is not uniquely, but particularly blind to the machinations of a sociopath, because they cannot see that anybody would lack conscience. And sociopaths or malignant narcissists lack conscience. They don't see the pain and suffering that they cause in other people. They only see what's good for them. And, you know, there is this brilliant book that I read after I left by a Harvard professor, Dr. Martha Stout, called The Sociopath Next Door. And that book changed my perspective on a lot of things. And she describes in there that there is this personality type that will victimize those around them in order to achieve what gives them power and satisfies their egos. And that the biggest problem in dealing with sociopaths is that people cannot envisage that is how they could be. They project themselves onto the sociopath and come up with an explanation and an answer and a reason and make it all somehow make sense as to why this person is doing these terrible things. And that is sort of the hallmark of an empath. An empath looks at someone else and goes, you know, I feel for them. How can I help? How can I do something for them? And that's what you find in Scientology. There are a lot of empaths. And today, there is a sociopath that is running Scientology, David Miscavige. Prior to him taking over and seizing power after the death of L. Ron Hubbard, there was L. Ron Hubbard, who was perhaps not a sociopath as much as a malignant narcissist. But, I'll leave the clinical definitions to others, but I did read Martha Stout's book, so I consider myself a semi-expert.
Yeah, well, that we're going to add that one to our reading list. That sounds great. It's it, I really appreciate you mentioning that, Mike, because as I said earlier, one of the things that was revealing to me about the book is what I mentioned earlier, but also the level of sophistication within the church. These are the people that, like you and the people that you were working with, these are people. I mean, I could not believe how hard you worked. It was slavish, just assiduous labor, exhausting labor. People would not believe how hard you worked, and highly intelligent, capable people who probably would have been successful, highly successful in any type of endeavor, but they just happened to be in the Church of Scientology. But the other thread that runs through your story is a shocking level of abuse that you suffered. And there's this one scene, we're going to show a little video of Mr. Miscavige, but there's one scene in the book where he comes bounding out of his office and shoves you to the ground into a bush. And you're like, what on earth is going on? And I'm thinking, I mean, like most readers, I'm thinking, okay, Mike, just get up and punch him out. You're in Australia for crying out loud, right? And then he invites you in his office, he pours you a scotch, and then you have a conversation, you just accept it. And this level of abuse, and some of the stories of really POW level abuse that people were subjected to, it's really, really incredible. It defies belief. I just couldn't believe that people would take that. But I guess that ties back into the level of seduction that the whole ethos of the Church in Scientology, that the hold that it had over people mentally and emotionally, right?
Yes, I mean, Larry Wright called his brilliant book Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief as a subtitle. And he is absolutely right. Look, there are a couple of things about this, Leighton, that I think sort of bear explanation or a little further explanation. Because, I look back, when I was writing the book, I look back and go, what sort of a wimp was I that I just put up with this for so long? But I also had some editors who were very, very insistent to me because, honestly, to begin with, my first draft of my book read like a legal brief. It was very fact, fact, fact. This happened, that happened, this happened, that happened. They said, no. This is the prison of belief. You've got to delve into what you were thinking, what was going through your mind at the time. How did you view this? And so I made a pretty concerted effort to try and explain the thought processes. And there are two very, very important things that bear on this. Why do Scientologists or Sea Org members in particular put up with the ridiculous levels of abuse that they are subjected to? And one of them is very similar to what I was saying to you earlier, this grand scheme of we are saving every man, woman, and child on Earth. Our individual comfort, whether we're sleeping on the floor and eating rice and beans or being yelled at or punched in the face is all irrelevant when compared to this overall big picture of this vital job that we have to do. And if everybody else is uncomfortable or is sleeping on the floor too, so I can stand it if they can stand it. And I can put these things aside as problems or something to really focus on and focus instead on the big picture of saving the planet and every man, woman, and child on it. But then there is a second aspect that is very insidious in Scientology, and it is paraphrased and used as sort of an often used saying in Scientology. What did you do to pull it in?
Pull it in, yeah.
And this concept comes from the sort of Hubbard taking the idea of karma and formalizing it into a very, very rigid, scientifically researched dicta that says, for anything bad to happen to you or for you to receive something unwanted in your life, you had to have done something similar to that to someone else priorly. So if a stranger walked up to me on the sidewalk and punched me in the face, the Scientology reaction to that is not, oh my God, what's the deal with that guy? The Scientology reaction is to sit you down and take you into what's called an auditing session, a Scientology confessional or, you know, counseling, and say, when did you punch someone in the face? Because the belief is that if you can find the first time that you did something similar, you will no longer have the need for someone to punch you in the face, so you will have solved the problem permanently. And this idea, so I'm thrown in the bushes by David Miscavige punching me in the face, splitting my lip, whatever, and the thought that goes through my mind as a good Scientologist is, what did I do to pull this in? Not, is David Miscavige a lunatic, or he's just lost it, he's a nut job. It's, what did I do to pull it in? And you couple that with this idea of the grand accomplishment of saving everybody on Earth, and that my well-being and comfort and sleep and food, etc., is all tinily insignificant compared to that grand scheme. And you have a recipe for people being repeatedly and constantly abused and thinking that they deserve it or that it's not worth worrying about.
Even getting blamed for interviews with Ted Koppel that go wrong, which is what happened to you. So let's watch just a little clip of this, if we could, Devin, just to show, because it is talked about in the book.
Well, number one, I would never try to talk you into that Scientology is for you. You see, that's the funny thing about this, is if I'm now going to give a sales pitch to you on Scientology, believe me, Scientology is valuable enough that it doesn't require any sales pitch. But let's look at it this way then, what Scientology does. If you look out across the world today, you could say that if you take a person who's healthy, doing well, like yourself, you'd say that that person is normal, not a crazy, not somebody who's a psychotic. You look at a wall and they call it an elephant. Would you agree with me on that?
So far, I don't.
Okay, and you can see people below that.
Right.
And crazy people, criminals, that I think society in general will look at and say, that breed of person hasn't something quite right because they're not up to this level of personality. You can understand that. Well, we in Scientology are not. You see, all past attempts have been to bring man up to somebody's standard of what's normal. What we're trying to do in Scientology is take somebody from this higher level and move them up to greater ability. You see, we're interested in...
What about those folks down there?
Well, yes, no, we don't ignore them, but my point is this. Scientology is there to help the able become more able. The guy who's going around, he's working, he's trying to make it. These people generally have something in their life that they would like to improve. And in any event, if you can increase that person's ability, the one who's chipping in, the one who's able, and bring him up higher, the sphere of influence that he affects in the world around him can be much greater, and he can get on and do better.
So that interview reveals a little bit of I guess your description of him was a sociopath. You could see a little bit of that there. But what's interesting is the aftermath of that story, of course, was that you got blamed, that this went horribly wrong, and you had to take responsibility for, even though it was none of your doing. And then there was a subsequent interview you did with Katie Couric where you actually had to lie. But Mike, when we're talking about Scientology and its hold on you, one of the things that was really struck me again about the book was, even after you got to the point at 52, after a lifetime of being in the Church of Scientology, and you finally got the courage, you know, that day in London, and you kind of snuck away on the train. It's like a James Bond scene. But even after you know, leaving your wife and your grown children behind, and you wrote that beautiful letter to them that, by the way, is on Mike's blog if you want to read it. Even after you got out, you still regarded yourself as a Scientologist. You didn't fully reject the sort of theology of the Church of Scientology. That really astonished me. Can you explain a little bit about that? Why that was, even after you made the decision to leave this sort of lifelong quest that you were on and to break away. And of course you went on to form a new family and met the love of your life and have another beautiful child. But why was it? How could you stay a Scientologist? And what was it ultimately that broke that hold on you?
Okay, that's a terrific question, Leighton. I analogize getting out of Scientology to peeling an onion. That you don't get to the heart of it right at the first blush or the first moment, that it takes some time, some distance, some space before you can start looking at things through a different lens. I've been asked a number of times now, do you think if L. Ron Hubbard was still alive that you would still be in the Sea Org? And, you know, it's a lot of hypotheticals, but generally my answer to that is probably yes. Because wow. What happened was the deprivations of David Miscavige, what finally put me and got me to the point where I said, look, nothing could be worse than this. My life is a disaster. What had held me for so long was the fact that I didn't want to abandon my children and my wife, even though, as you will read in the book, you know, abandoning my children is, they were abandoned from the moment they were born into the Sea Organization, frankly. And a marriage in the Sea Organization is not like a traditional marriage. I didn't spend a lot of time even in the same city with my wife for many, many, many years. But when Miscavige basically told me, screw you, you're never coming back to the United States, and therefore I'll never see my children and wife again, I went, okay, that's it. And I escaped. And escaped is actually the word. It is not left, it is escaped. You have to plot and plan to figure out how to circumvent the mechanisms that are in place to prevent someone like me from getting into the outside world and leaving the Sea Organization. But when I escaped, I believe that the problem of Scientology, or the problems that I were experiencing, were the doings of David Miscavige, the course that he had set for Scientology was not what L. Ron Hubbard would have done over the ensuing years since Miscavige took over, and that while there were problems with some of the things that Hubbard had written, particularly about the disconnection of families and the use of ethics in Scientology, that there was much to still be lauded and regarded as valuable to mankind in the research that he had done. The thing that finally, as I got further and further away and was able to sort of get outside of this bubble of information and the, you know, the sort of confirmation bias that comes with living and working with people who all see things the same way you do. And, you know, as time went by, I started reading more. You know, I mentioned Martha Stout's book. I read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which is an astonishing book, and somehow gave me enormous comfort and and sort of inspiration. And then I read a book by Russell Miller called Barefaced Messiah. And Russell Miller is, this is an unauthorized biography of L. Ron Hubbard. And Russell Miller was a reporter for the Times of London, and he was an astonishingly thorough researcher. And reading that book opened my eyes to the fact that L. Ron Hubbard, from 2 years old, from the first words that he could ever speak, was a storyteller or a bullshitter, whichever one you want, whichever term you want to use. And that he had told a lot of stories about himself that were demonstrably and provably untrue. And that as he moved into the world of nonfiction, he told just as many stories that were untrue about the research that he had done and the life that he had led and the wives that he had and the bigamous marriage and all of these other things that were very, very covered up in the world of Scientology. Inside that bubble of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard is pretty close to a god. If L. Ron Hubbard said he sank Japanese submarines off the coast of Oregon in World War II and was a war hero, L. Ron Hubbard was right. And despite the fact that there is absolutely no record of this, and he had all sorts of problems being removed from command of little ships and shit in the Navy, his version of it was that he was a war hero that, you know, movies should have been made about. And this pervades also Scientology. And, you know, it's pretty incredible, Leighton, that, you know, I talk in the book about this brilliant stroke of evil genius that Hubbard had of developing this thing called the E-meter. And the E-meter is this device that is used in Scientology that is like a simple lie detector. It's a Wheatstone bridge. It measures electrical current resistance. Hubbard claimed that this E-meter, and Scientologists believe with utter certainty that this E-meter can read your thoughts. And it reads your thoughts below your conscious level. And therefore, you can be guided and steered by an auditor and this E-meter device into recounting things that you don't really think happened or maybe not really real, but the E-meter will tell you, yes, it is, yes, it is, yes, it is. And I talk a lot about that in the book, trying to describe the E-meter and its impact on Scientologists and their beliefs. But the start of the E-meter was Hubbard, he wrote this insane book called Scientology, A History of Man. And he calls it a cold-blooded factual account of your last 76 trillion years. That's like the first line of the book. And he had been using this E-meter, supposedly, to identify all of these past life incidents that people had. And they're all documented in this book, and they are lunatic crazy. However, Hubbard claimed that by advancing in Scientology, you would be able to have perfect recall of all these past lives you've had for quadrillions of years. But it would take a lot of work to get there, and, you know, most people are not capable of doing that. But of course, he was. Mm-hmm. He was capable of recalling all of this stuff. And so Hubbard started telling Scientologists that from his trillions of years of existence, he knew everything. And would start saying, I know how to run a planet with computers because I was on Planet Chug and blah, 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 and start spewing out all this stuff about here's how the computer should work. He said, you know, like anything that he came up with subsequent, you know, like that seemed incredible to anybody would be acceptable in Scientology and to Scientologists because Hubbard claimed this was part of his whole track recall. That he remembered the spaceships, he remembered the this, he remembered how this worked, how that worked. And even to the point today, there is part of Scientology where Scientologists literally pay $5,000 to run in circles around a pole. And someone stands there and tells them, keep running, keep running.
Wow.
This, Scientologists believe, is this wondrous level and creation that was developed by L. Ron Hubbard from his whole track research, where he said that individuals, when they died, would go out and circle a star in space for many, many years, and that would relieve them of the stress of having lost their body. And so it would realign their energy flows. And so to make that a reality in this world, you have to go and run around a pole. Now, Scientologists buy this. They not only buy it, they buy it with dollars. They pay $5,000 to do this and go run around a pole. Look, I can go run around a tree in my front yard right now and achieve exactly the same result, but I don't have to pay anybody anything for it. And, you know, this is the level of crazy that exists in Scientology. But it's all presented like this scientific, it's been researched, it's verified by the E-meter, and L. Ron Hubbard, his word is the word of God.
Mike, I'm not going to take issue with you on this, but part of the problem, though, and you talk about this in the book, is that while you were working within the Church of Scientology, you did have the impression at certain times that it was helping people. I'll give you an example. There's this famous scene that, of course, Tom Cruise was pilloried for at the time back, I believe, 2004, this famous interview with Matt Lauer, where mm-hmm. they give this exchange about psychiatry and about how the drugs really don't help. Well, you know, recently, you're probably aware of this, the pharmaceutical industry had to come out and admit that actually depression is actually not caused by a chemical imbalance of serotonin in the brain, and that there's really no connection. This is all a big lie. Well, Tom Cruise said that to Matt Lauer in 2004, and he was right. So was this part of the problem? Is that, of course, you know, Mr. Hubbard was a prolific writer. I think he wrote over 19 books, 45,000 pages, but it wasn't all rubbish, was it? Or was it?
No. It's not. No, far from it, Layton. Look, if everything in Scientology was rubbish, nobody would be in Scientology.
Right.
I mean, there's not that many stupid people in the world that are going to buy absolute crap and accept it and just, you know, pay their money and go bankrupt to buy it. No, Hubbard was a master, like I said, a master storyteller. He was also very widely read. He read a lot. He had dabbled in all sorts of things. He took bits and pieces from all over the place and took them and turned them into his philosophy or his research or his discoveries and presented them to the world. You have a lot of people in Scientology that will attest and claim that they have solved various problems in their life using these principles that Hubbard developed. And you can't take that away from them. Look, mm-hmm. they may be deluded, They may only be doing it because they have, 50 people around them that are all telling them that they achieved that. So, you know, they better come up with something that sounds good, because otherwise they're going to be a pariah amongst the 50 people around them. But you can't say that no person in Scientology has ever gotten anything out of it. People get something out of taking placebo pills too. If you believe that you are going to get something and it is promised to you, and if on top of that you pay for it, you have a tendency to believe that you have been helped and are very convinced of it. And maybe that's true. Maybe just the convincing yourself that you've been helped actually helps you. I don't, there's not been any scientific studies done of this, and there never will be. But the idea that everything in Scientology is just bullshit is not true, and it cannot be true. The idea that everything in Scientology is ultimately going to result in no result is also true. You do not achieve the ultimate objective of Scientology as promised, and nobody ever has, and nobody ever will. This just isn't ever going to occur. And that's sort of the biggest criticism that I could make of Scientology, is the promise, the ultimate promise. Even the levels of promise are never fulfilled, but there is always something else that is, okay, well, so we'll try this. So we'll have you run around a pole. Maybe that's the new big breakthrough that Ron made that will now make it possible for you to achieve the things that he said in Dianetics. Well, nobody has ever achieved the state of clear that he laid out in Dianetics, ever. And nobody ever will.
And that's sort of the brilliance of this business model. We haven't talked about that, but it's incredibly profitable, isn't it?
Oh, stunningly. I mean, the Scientology has accumulated billions of dollars. Billions. And takes in many millions every single week. And even though it is shrinking, the shrinking of the total membership and the sort of influence of Scientology around the world is making those who remain more desperate and more convinced that they need to give more, that they need to contribute more, that they need to work harder because they're not accomplishing this very important objective of saving the planet. So their revenues may not be going down, even though their numbers are. Eventually, you know, that's not a sustainable business model. As those people die off or run out of money, and there aren't new ones replacing them, that revenue stream is going to be reduced. But Scientology is an astonishingly wealthy organization. And, you know, I know that you're not in the United States, but there are, every taxpayer in the United States is subsidizing the activities of Scientology.
Right. Yeah. You explain about that in the book. Yeah.
And that is grotesque. Scientology is spending money on hiring private investigators and lawyers to harass people and buying websites and making videos to smear people. And that is all being paid for with tax-free money that taxpayers are subsidizing, and that is not an appropriate exempt organization activity and should not be tolerated, and the IRS should be reviewing and rescinding Scientology's tax-exempt status.
Incredible. So let's talk a little bit about what you're doing now, because you've sort of emerged and You're out, as it were. I know that your grown children are still in, your former wife, but you've come out and you've got this new life. you met this wonderful lady who you have this common history, that you were both raised in the Church of Scientology, and you started a new family. You got a young son. I guess you'd be a teenager now. We're getting close.
Well, no, he's 10.
He's 10?
He's 10.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, that's right. I thought it was 06. He's born in 2012. So you've got this new life, but you're not just sort of walking off into the sunset. You're still helping people. You spent your whole life in the Church of Scientology. You thought you were helping people. At least that's my impression. That was kind of your guiding motivation. That was my clear sense. You certainly weren't making any money.
No, I was not.
And so now you've continued this work, and on your blog, and I encourage people to visit Mike's blog. This is what you state. It is my intention to do everything I can to, one, expose the abuses ongoing in Scientology through this blog, media, podcasts, law enforcement, and elected officials to bring the wrongdoing to an end. Two, to help provide information to anyone looking for the truth about Scientology. Three, to provide a forum for the exchange of information. Four, to give a voice to those who are afraid, unable, or have no venue to speak about their experiences. And five, to inspire others to take a stand and speak out against abuses. So was that really the impetus for writing the book, Mike?
Yes. Leighton, I addressed the book to the two children that I brought into the C organization. And, you know, I say, if I knew then what I know now, they certainly would not have been put into that position. I feel a responsibility for that. I feel a responsibility to do whatever I can to give them the opportunity to have the freedom of choice to make up their own mind. If they want to be Scientologists, they can be Scientologists. I just want them to have both sides of this story and to know not just what they are fed inside that bubble, but what the reality is of the outside world. And I've said a couple of times now, I spent a large part of my life thinking I was saving the world with Scientology. Now I believe I'm saving the world from Scientology. And that, you know, it was living a life where you have this grand purpose and this big picture objective to attain. When I escaped, that vanished, and that left a void in my life. And, you know, when you've sort of lived that life of this big, big sort of grand scope of things, it's hard to not have something to replace it. And this activism, whistleblowing, whatever you want to call it, to help people get out of Scientology or whatever bad circumstance they may find themselves in, has really replaced that in my life. It gives me a higher purpose, a bigger objective than just, you know, making enough money to pay the bills this week and, you know, go to the beach on Saturday. Mm-hmm. So I hope that my book will speak to people, not just about Scientology and not even just about cults or high control groups, but anybody who finds themselves in a bad relationship or a bad situation in life or a bad job, or they're unhappy and think that their fate is sealed. It is not. You can change. It is possible to change the circumstances of your life. The old adage, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, is actually not true. I was an old dog and I have learned new tricks. I have changed my life entirely after walking out of the life that I had known and leaving behind everything, everybody I knew, having no money, having no resume. I mean, it's not much of a resume to walk in for a job interview and say, I was the international spokesperson for the Church of Scientology for 20 years. So it's possible. And I want people to know that it is possible and that a great deal of happiness can be attained if you take the steps necessary to get there.
It is a wonderful work. I'm so glad that I had the chance to read it. It should be made into a movie. We can be confident that neither John Travolta or Tom Cruise will be starring in it. but it should be made into a movie. It's just an incredible story. It even has some really funny parts in. One of the ones that's memorable is when you got to meet Michael Jackson and Lisa Marie Presley, and he's hitting the deck because he thinks that the paparazzi are after him.
Right.
So there, I don't want people to think about this book, it's all doom and gloom. It just has a little bit of everything in it. But ultimately, it's a human story, and it's a story of triumph. It's a story of redemption. It's a story of someone who searched his whole life for the truth and found it, and now is telling it. So it's a beautiful book. And so it's on our reading list. It's strongly recommended. Mike, this is the part of our program where we hit something called the reading list. You've already given us a couple of great selections. And if you want to add a couple more, that would be great. I know there are a number of books that you list on your blog. And I've got a couple here, actually, that I'm recommending, and I'll let you finish off. One of them that I found is a book called The Church of Fear by a man named John Sweeney.
Yes,
I believe this is listed on your blog. But
yes,
it's here. The description is: Tom Cruise and John Travolta say the Church of Scientology is a force for good. Others disagree. Award-winning journalist John Sweeney investigated the church for more than half a decade. During that time, he was intimidated, spied on, and followed. The results were spectacular. Sweeney lost his temper with the church's spokesman on camera, and his famous exploding tomato clip was seen by millions around the world. And I mentioned that one because it is actually talked about in your book.
At some length.
Yes. And so that one I strongly recommend. The other one is one called My Billion Year Contract. And this is a memoir by a lady named Nancy Menny. But she has a different perspective because she, sort of like Mike, came to the Church of Scientology as a teenage girl, and Scientology seemed to be just what she was looking for, a way to improve herself, attain spiritual enlightenment. But it was only after she joined Scientology's elite inner circle, like Mike, the Sea Org, and signed a billion-year contract that she discovered the dark world of fanaticism and abuse at the center of Scientology's vast empire. So for more than two decades, she worked at all levels of the organization, from serving as a personal aide to the founder of Scientology, Mr. Hubbard, who placed her in charge of the religion's worldwide expansion, to becoming the head of Celebrity Center, the organization that caters to its celebrity members. So those are two selections that I would suggest as maybe companion pieces to Mike's incredible book. Mike, do you have some other selections that you'd like to share with people who want to follow up on this discussion, having listened to you for the last hour or so?
Yes, I would certainly recommend Going Clear by Lawrence Wright. A brilliant analysis, summation of the history of Hubbard and Scientology. I would also recommend Troublemaker by Leah Remini, the story of how she came to extricate herself from Scientology. That book is very typical Leah, very both poignant and funny.
So she's the actress from the television series King of Queens, right?
Right. And okay, and yeah. Leah and I did three seasons of a television show on the A&E network called Leah Remini, Scientology in the Aftermath, where we told the stories of survivors of Scientology.
And can people still watch those, Mike? Are those still
Yes.
there?
I mean, you can find them on the A&E website. They're on Hulu. They were on Netflix for the last few years and just went off at the beginning of this month. But, you know, they're certainly available if you look for them. And another one that I think is a very wonderful book is called Blown for Good by Mark Headley. Mark Headley is a very, very dear friend of mine who was also in the same location that I was. He and his wife were both there where a lot of the crazy went on, and it's the story of his escape and experiences that he had there. And, you know, there's many more. I have a list of suggested reading in the back of my book, but those are the three that I would pick off the top of my head, along with Barefaced Messiah and Martha Stout, The Sociopath Next Door. So wonderful. There you go.
Thanks so much, Mike. It's been such an illuminating conversation. I'm so glad that I got to talk with you. And I'm so grateful for your book. As I said, it's a story of great courage. And it, as I said, it's absolutely riveting. I'm telling people who are taking this in, I'm not kidding. And people who listen to this podcast know I consume about 3 books a week. This is the best book that I have written or that I have read probably in the last 4 or 5 years. Just could not stop reading it. Just brilliant book. And I think a very important book, because there's so much ignorance among us WOGs about Scientology. And, you know, Mike is trying to edify us and make us understand what's going on with the Church of Scientology so that we'll be aware and we can be wary about being drawn in to this organization or cult or religion or whatever it is. It's certainly not something that's doing good in the world, and it isn't helping people. It isn't raising people to a higher plane of consciousness, and it certainly isn't helping them spiritually. But in order to understand what something is, you've got to first take a long look at it. Before you can do that, you've got to sort of peel the top off of, or peel off the onion, as Mike puts it, which he does in his book. So, Mike, I'm so grateful for your time today and for writing the book. Thank you so much for being our special guest today on Gray Matter. And best of luck in all of your future endeavors. I hope that there's a sequel to A Billion Years. I hope you write another, perhaps about, you know, what you've done afterwards, you know, after your a quote-unquote escape.
Thank you so much, Leighton. It was a real pleasure chatting with you today, and I appreciate the very kind words that you had to say about the book. That means a lot to me. Thank you.
All right. Take care, sir.
Okay, you too.